Eva Teichman, Reel 3.
Yes, I have to mention that the Arrowcross took away my husband from the bakery because one of his friend's wife was Christian, and I somehow, somebody followed her, and I knew that some Jewish boys were in the bakery hiding, and I came to arrest him, and I took him in the, it's called the Arrowcross for the worst place that the Arrowcross occupied, that house. It's called the death house of the Arrowcross. And I put him in a cellar. I took away his gloves, his ring. He said, "Ooh, Jew, you won't need that because you will float in the Danube." And he heard screams, young boys, young people screaming because I fed them this salt herring and I didn't give them water. I tortured him. And he was there a few days, or maybe a week, and I came down and asked, "Who can repair a Mercedes car?" My husband, he said, "I can," because he had a Mercedes car in Yugoslavia, and luckily he managed to repair the car. And from then on, he was like one of them. I gave him food, and I let him go, and gave him a letter. Anybody who asks him, this letter will protect him. So he came to where we were already in one of the Swedish houses, and from then on we were together. But we planned our escape in case the Arrowcross comes in and wants to take us to the ghetto. And we planned to climb out the window, but our planning didn't go through because we were liberated. But before that, when it was the terrible bombing, and we did see it hopeless, we went back, two of us, to the bakery, crawling, because the bombs were falling down, and he was worried about me, and I was down, and he was covering me. I shouldn't be injured, but luckily we arrived in the bakery, and we were there a few days, and then we ran back because I was worried for my parents.
Yes, how about your parents? Where were they?
But my parents went. It was called the International Ghetto of people who had such passes, Swedish, Swiss, Spanish, Portuguese. They were in that part of Budapest. It was called the Lipótváros. And my father told me that they were taken in one of the houses and a soldier came to take me to meet my mother. It was with her crying as I see her. I never forget. Then I was taken back to Tatel Tzahar, 6, and then my husband, my father, came to tell me, as he was bringing the bread for the house, that my husband was, then my fiancé, was taken away by the Arrow Cross. And as you can imagine, I was very, very worried what was going to happen. And I went down to the office. And then it was, Wallenberg was there. And I begged him to help him, to get him out, and to find out where he was. And there was another man who became later a very good friend of ours, Béla Rozman, whose wife died Tatra Utca 6 during a bombing attack. And I begged Wallenberg to find out where he was taken, and he promised me that he will do all he can to find out, to go to the places where they were. Telekitero, Józef Város, it was a station where they'd taken. And I went down a few times to the office to ask if they could find out something. And they told me they'd do their best, but I had to be patient, because I was very anxious. And then I moved out, and Wallenberg was very, very nice, very sympathetic. And then I moved back out to my parents. We were 9 of us in a room. And then my husband came as well. And we got together. And I took my friend with me. And there was no food there. And my mother, whatever they brought with them, flowers, she made whatever she could. And I remember I was screwing up the soup kitchens for food. And I didn't want to eat. I wanted my fiancé to eat rather. And it was very, very difficult times. We didn't have electricity. It was cut off.
This is in the international...
Nothing. It was in winter time.
And this is in the international ghetto?
Yes, it was. In Dachau, so.
Could you tell me more about Wallenberg and what you knew about him at the time?
First, we knew that he was Count Wallenberg, because he was so respected. We thought he was an aristocrat. And somebody mentioned that he was a count, so we called him Count Wallenberg. And then we heard how many people he did save, and what work he had done. What fantastic man he was, that he stood up to the Arrow Cross, because many times he had such an authority. Many times they didn't acknowledge the trespasses. Yes, they tore it up and they said, this is not a, that's nothing for us, it's only a piece of paper. But he did, he was fantastic, he was a legend, and all these days with me because he saved my life as well as many thousands of lives. And how fortunate that he's not here to tell his story of what happened to him.
What was he like as a man?
He was tall, as I remember. Very nice mannered. Very, very nice man. And I had the opportunity to see him many times. Very friendly. And you could see the kindness in his eyes. And there was many, many people who tried to do the job that he did.
Did he speak Hungarian?
I think I talked to him in German. Maybe he did speak a few words of Hungarian, but he had other Swedish colleagues with him who was at that dinner.
Did he work very hard at this time? You know, in this Swedish office, did he work long hours and very hard?
But mainly he was out to help people. Because he didn't spend too much time in the office. His work was to get the people away and in shelters where they are not in danger, get as many out of the Aerocross clutches. That was his main aim.
How many people, I wonder, did he save, so far as you knew? You know, what were people...
Thousands and thousands, at least 10,000 or even more. A lot of people. He saved as many as he could. He was a fantastic man.
Was that important for people's morale to have someone like him there?
Oh yes, of course. Of course. That somebody was helping, that the Swede who had no connection to the Hungarian Jewish people came like a Messiah to get us out as many as he could save. Of course it was fantastic, but his work, what he done.
So you would have met him mainly in the office, would you?
Yes, I did, and especially when my husband was taken, and I went down and begged him to find out where he is. Yes, everybody, all his Swedish colleague, but he was very, very sympathetic and promised to find out where he was and get him back to safety.
Where did he himself live in Budapest? You know, did he live in the Swedish office?
I think so. Yes, I think so he did, because it was a big flat. Yes, there was three or four rooms, which was only Swedish territory, luckily.
I think,
as I said before, the Aerocross had no right and no power. They could not cross the threshold.
You were also saying earlier, I think, Ava, that these Schutz passes, you had them from other countries as well. Is that right? Not only the Swedes, were giving the passes, but there were other countries too.
Yes, yes, there were countries who tried to help, yes.
But what were the other countries?
I know that France had Portuguese Swiss passes, Spanish, Swiss, and a lot of them had Swedish Swiss passes.
Were you at this time aware of how the war was going, particularly the Russian advances in the east? You know, did you get war news in Hungary?
Yes, we did have, because when I was still at home, we were not allowed to have a radio. We had to hand it in when the German occupied us. And we went into a neighbor who did save a lot of our stuff, what we gave them, and we got it back after the war. And we went in to hear the BBC One. I did understand, not a lot, because we were studying English, and we heard the BBC's Beethoven's Fifths, and I understood what was going on, and that's how we knew. And there were some friends who brought some news, so we did know what's going on. Not much, but we did know about the invasion and we were hoping that we'd be saved. Somehow I could not imagine myself to be taken away. I just couldn't. I felt myself that I would not leave Hungary and taken to concentration camps. Unfortunately, a lot of friends disappeared, and my cousins. And in Yugoslavia, my mother, old father, my grandfather were taken away, aunts, uncles, young cousins, nephews, and I've been all gassed near Belgrade, as we later knew. Yes, we went through a lot, awful lot. We did send somebody to get out, my aunt and my niece, with false papers, and she said no, she wouldn't leave her husband, my uncle. So they died together.
So an awful lot of your family.
My husband's parents, my mother-in-law, went in the gas chamber because she was holding on to an old person. She didn't want to let her go. She was only 52. And my father-in-law and my brother-in-law, they lived through. But then they knew the German, that the Russian army, they emptied, they evacuated, and they Auschwitz, and they took them out, and they shot all of them. That we learned later after the war. My father-in-law and one of my brother-in-law. Master always said, only one of my brothers should have come back, only one. He felt terrible that he was one who survived. He never talked about them afterwards, never. It's such a terrible pain he had. That's why when my sons were born, he wanted two sons to replace his lost brothers. I remember when my first son was born, he was so happy. He said to the gynecologist, he said, you get 6 bottles of champagne if it's a boy. And so we did give him 6 bottles of champagne. He was crying with happiness, especially when my second son was born and there was a boy.
Are they named for his dead brothers? Did he give them the name? Did you give them the names?
Yes, it was in Hungarian, Shami, it was Alexander, and Alfred, his younger brother who died in Russia. When I met him in 1943, he told me about him and he was crying like I am. He was very, very attached to him. He loved his brother, and when I knew that what happened to him, he was very upset, terrible, terrible fate what he had. He was mourning them all his life. He couldn't get over it. But as I said, I knew, but he didn't talk about it. Very seldom.
How about yourself? Did you talk about your experiences, did you find?
After the war, we met friends and we were very happy that so many still alive and people told their story. It was, everybody's story was unique. Fantastic how people escaped. Some of them with forged papers. Very good friend of ours and his sister escaped with forged papers and lived with people who sheltered them. And some of them just, it was a matter of luck, really, that we stayed alive. It was a miracle. Because when the Russians liberated us on the 16th of January, we didn't go down to the cellars, to the shelter. But that night we went down because it was terrible bombing. And then in the morning we came out of the shelter. My mother, my fiancé and me, because my father was in the hospital, we took over for him his belongings and in case they take him to the ghetto. And we came up and the Russians were there. And you can imagine our joy. And he took off my Star of David and he threw it down and stepped on it and he said, "You don't need this." My husband, as he was Yugoslav, he could talk to them, they understood each other, because it's a Slavic language. And then told it to my father, and we were very happy that we were liberated. But of course, we didn't know how it was with the Russian bit later on, when they raped as well, and in the ghetto they shot a lot of people as well, raping, looting, terrible. We went back to our home, and when we heard that the Russians are coming, banging on the doors, they didn't come to our flat because my husband and I, as she was Yugoslav, we put a big note on the door that we are Yugoslavs, so they didn't come in. And when we went out, very seldom he let me out, because they liked young, nice-looking women. We always went together, and we had on the Yugoslav armband. But it happened that they were shouting, "Come, davai, davai, come and peel potatoes for us." So we were running and running, so they just let us go. And they behaved like animals. So after the war, my husband had a doctor friend who worked in a big hospital, and we approached him to take my father away from that hospital and take him to a proper hospital where they had some medicine. I remember we put him on a
on a cart.
Mm-hmm. We put him on a cart and took him to the hospital, and there was terrible conditions. He was put in a corridor. It was full up, of course, with injured people, the hospital. But our doctor friend got a bed for him, and his leg was in a very bad state, so I gave him blood standing, I remember, and I wasn't so strong, and the blood didn't help at all. It was all, it was already gangrene, the leg, so it had to be amputated. The doctor told us, if the leg does not, if it's not amputated, he will die, because his body was full with gangrene already, and he didn't want to hear about it. I was begging him, "Please, please, you will be alone. You will be with us. Please." And my uncle went and met him, and my mother didn't know about it. I didn't know how to tell her. So in the end, he agreed. I remember when I went home and told my mother, she just fainted. And I told her, "But at least he's alive." And he lived to 91. And he said afterwards, "I don't mind my leg. The main thing that you and my son are alive." Because he loved us both. And later my brother said that I was his favorite. And we knew about my brother only through the Red Cross, as he was in then Palestine. Every month we were able to send 25 words, and he back to us, so he knew that we are alive. And after the war, I didn't know how to write to him what happened to father.